across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is definitely The Unexplained. Good to have you there, wherever in the world you are. As I'm recording this, it's kind of late afternoon, the beginning of the evening time. The light level is very low, and it's very, very dull. It's a tiny little break in the cloud, but apart from that, London is covered in a canopy of grey. And I guess that's how things are going to be until we're released from the autumn and the winter around about next March. So if I could sort of go to bed now and wake up in the springtime, nobody would be... Well, if I could manage not to age, you know, a few months in that time, I'd be very happy. Hey, listen, thank you very much for all of your emails. Very, very kind of you. Please keep them coming. They mean a great deal to me. If you want to get in touch with me, make a guest suggestion, or give me thoughts about the show, do whatever you want to do, go to the website, theunexplained.tv. There is a link there for emails. Please follow that link. And thank you very much to Adam for his hard work on the website, theunexplained.tv. And please don't forget to patronize my Facebook page, the official Facebook page of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. No other Facebook page, the official Facebook page of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. And it's nice to see your presence there. I keep you up to date about the show, the online show, the radio show, all the stuff we're doing on there. So if there are any developments to do with the radio show in the future, or indeed the podcast, I will put them there on my Facebook page. And you'll always be able to go back to that and reference that to know where we're at this point in time, as politicians tend to say. Don't start me about politicians at the moment. I'm actually trying, you know, as a lifelong news person, lately I've been trying to turn off the news, because I just don't think I'm getting anywhere by listening to it. And to some extent, that's been helping, really. I think these shows are more of the real news than what we're getting on the news, I think. I don't know. It's way above my pay grade, and I'm not even going to think about it at all. Now, on this edition of the show, you're going to hear my conversation with Tony Rodrigues. He is a man who says that he has been part of the secret space program and has spent 20 years working as part of that, doing service on places like Mars. It is an extraordinary story, told in a very credible way. I don't know whether it's exactly as it happened. The decision about that is for you to make up. I don't know. I think it's a great story. I find it very interesting, and I think Tony Rodrigues tells it in a very straightforward and, like I say, very credible way. But it's not for me here to sit in judgment on anybody. Sometimes I get emails from people saying, you can't possibly agree with whatever guest X, Y, or Z said in the last show. And of course, that is not the point of this. The point of this is to elicit as much information as clearly as I can from a guest, and hopefully they're good guests. And then we take it from there, or rather you take it from there. That's always been, over all of these years that I've been doing this show, and that's a total of 17 now, if you include its first incarnation, that's always been the mantra behind the show. And I think it should continue that way. Like I say, thank you very much for all of your emails. Please keep them coming. And very important, now that I'm doing my own guest booking again, Haley has had to cease to do that. So, you know, thank you very much to Haley for all that she did. I am now back doing that. It is a challenge, because like I've said before, I mean, I love doing it. Of course I do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be. But on a Monday, I have to wake up, come up with all the ideas and guest contact details and everything else for the radio show, and also sort out the podcast and book the guests for the podcast. So, you know, life has got a little bit more involved lately. So any guest suggestions or contact details for guests, gratefully received. You can send them to me at theunexplained.tv. Okay, let's get to the guest on this edition of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. Tony Rodrigues, taken from my radio show, talking about his time in the Secret Space Force. The Secret Space Program, what is it? We'll be finding out with Tony Rodrigues in Michigan, USA, who's been listening to all of that. Tony, thank you for coming on the show.
Howard, thanks for having me. I'm a pleasure to be here.
This is going to be a difficult one to do, because I think there's an awful lot of ground to cover. I want to start with the nuts and bolts first, if I may. I've listened to a couple of podcasts with you and read a transcript of one interview with you today, just by way of preparation. I don't like to do an awful lot of that, because I think it'll color the way that I do the conversation, and I don't want to do that. But I did do that. I didn't hear any of them on which you talked about you now. You know, who is Tony Rodrigues? What does he do? and, you know, what's his place in the world. So talk to me about Tony first.
Thanks. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you got my name right. It's Rod Riggs, and most people are unaware that that pronunciation even exists. So thank you for that. I'm a normal blue collar guy. I'm a woodworker. I refinish wood floors and in residential areas. I've been doing it for like 30 years in my life. I raised three daughters. Two of them just moved out recently. I got a teenage daughter at home, and you know, I'm a pretty normal kind of run of the mill guy. What happened to me may or may not have shaped the trajectory of my life. It sure did give me, you know, I was taken when I was 10 years old, and it sure did change my behavior immediately after.
Okay. So I want to get into the detail of that. I'm just trying to get, you know, an idea of you, and you've given me a very clear idea that I didn't hear on any of those things that I listened to today. That, you know, sure. From what you're telling me, you're a very ordinary guy, but you're a very ordinary person to whom very extraordinary things have happened in his lifetime.
I would have to agree. Well, and then what I found is since coming going public with the things I've remembered is that it's not very uncommon. I've literally been contacted by thousands of people that have similar experiences.
Thousands?
Thousands of people, yes. And so much so that I had to begin charging because I couldn't keep up with the volume. And it was just to kind of, weed it out because I was starting to make people angry at me because I couldn't get back to them all. Sometimes I get, 5 and 10 a week. Usually about 2 to 3 people a week contact me after they see my information, and a light goes off and they realize that something similar happened to them. So it's a very common, well, I don't know about very common, but it's a fairly common phenomenon. There's a big infrastructure around the Secret Space Program by now. And it's a very big, operation, which is going on.
But is that international then? Do you get emails
absolutely.
From people here in the UK?
Yes, absolutely. All over the world. Mm-hmm. And then I don't get any from, the English speak, obviously the English. I've had a few of my interviews transcribed or translated to Spanish and Portuguese that are down in South America. And the same thing happens. As soon as one of the interviews plays, I get in, I think one went off in Brazil and I got at least a dozen people right after that one, after an interview that was translated to Portuguese. So it's definitely a global thing.
I've talked on this show over the years, I think both of them for the radio show, not for the podcast version, I think. I'd have to check back with two people, at least, who've said that they have been part of a, quote, secret space program. Their accounts are all different, but the core of them is the same. The way that it is portrayed is that there is this, it's nothing to do with the one that Donald Trump established, the Space Force. This is something very, very different, and it's been going on for years, according to the accounts of people who've been connected with it. People are involuntarily taken when young and inducted into an almost military style of service, but it's not just service, it is a kind of servitude for a period, and then returned home again, not having aged at all, so nobody knows, apart from the person who went through it, what's happened.
And even them, so they do a very good job of erasing memories when they put you back as well. So that's really the anomaly for me, is I was not supposed to remember what I do. And I got my memories back, and you always get bleed through, and most people can't make sense of the bleed through memories, flashes of things that are not dreams. They don't make any sense. And
what's the difference? Okay, sorry to jump in here because I think we've got to be very specific. So I just want to nail this here, and then we can get into the detail of your case. What's the difference between this and the stories that we've heard of alien abduction? Only a week or two ago, it was the 60th anniversary of the Betty and Barney Hill case, which I'm sure you know, but this is very, very different, it seems to me, from that.
Well, what's different from... Possibly no difference, because both of them have very little recollection of what happened after the abduction. So their memories were erased, and they did not get memory recall. So what we're seeing is there's a very small percentage of people that have the ability to recall what happened to them. something like 2-3% of people that get abducted in, well, they get taken into these programs, 2-3% of them retain memories, and usually not a great deal of memory, you know, a very 20-30% of the memory of what happened. Some people retain more. That's the anomaly with me, is that I retain a higher amount of my memories. And I was able to corroborate some things with researchers to prove my account.
Really? We need to get into that. So of those people, those many, many people who get in touch with you, are most of them people who have heard what you've had to say? And we will, like I say, get into that. And some of it has chimed with them, and they've thought, well, something's been bugging me all my life long, or for however long it might be. I'm thinking this is it.
Yes. Well, so what happens is, and I'm talking in a typical sense, certainly, you know, it's a wide field. And the reason why ufology, a lot of it isn't uniform, is because people are being taken by all kinds of different programs and different species and with different levels of technology. So one abduction may be a completely different experience from another abduction. So what happened to me was a human-based program, a program that was owned by, you know, a faction of people that had access to higher military technology that had been trading with extraterrestrials. So there's an infrastructure in place throughout the solar system for these programs. And they've traded technology, they've acquired the technology through trade from extraterrestrial species. And so they have access to radical technology. Like you said, they can age regress people and put you back in time to the, you know, they say typically it's 15 to 30 minutes after you were taken. So they can take you.
Wow.
And you can live for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm speaking in typical terms because I hear different versions, but typically it's 20 years and then they put you back. And some people have the genetics to go to do a 20 year tour, go back, and then 20 years later be taken again and do another 20 year tour. So, but not everybody has those genetics. I did not. I had the genetics to go one time.
No. So clearly, whatever they have the technology to do defies the laws of physics and physiology as we understand them. And you're saying that has happened to quite a number of people. There are maybe people hearing this right now that's happened to, and they don't even know that that's happened to them because, as you say, they have this ability to take you out of your body when young, take you away somewhere, put you into a program where you serve forcibly, and then stick you back 20 years later, but in real time here, only half an hour or so has elapsed, which is quite alarming. So are you telling me, let's be very clear about this then, that there is a group of people here, I don't know how long they've been around for, but a group of people here who've been doing deals with extraterrestrials to obtain their technology. They are trading with space. They are aware of space in greater detail than NASA is aware of space, by far. And this has all been going on behind people's backs for a very long time. Is that a fair summation, or is it different?
Yeah, at least 100 years. Others, we've had rumors of other societies throughout history, deep in, you know, not that I know of conclusively. I can say for the last 100 years, like, I was basically taken and sold from program to program. So I was a piece of equipment that was taken. And when I was done, when I lost the effectiveness at whatever job they had me do, mm-hmm. I was re-rolled and gave me aptitude tests and put me into a new job. And I eventually was sold off at a certain time to the Mars Colony Corporation for a support soldier military role. And that was a very short time. And that program got canceled. And so they gave me aptitude tests to see what I was ideal for. And then basically it was ship maintenance. And I was retrained and then sold off to the Ceres Colony Corporation. And that's where I spent most of my time up there. And that was a breakaway German group. So these were people from, they identified as Deutsch people. And it's a culture that came from Germany. So I believe in the 20s, the German government, the German military acquired faster than light, you know, space travel.
But there's always been talk, wasn't there, that Hitler had a space program before the American space program, and, you know, the Nazi Bell and all of those experiments that were done by Germany. None of it's been comprehensively stood up, but there's an awful lot of talk about it.
So I'm trying to word it without skipping forward into, you know, greatly into events that have happened. But
sure. I want to drill into each of these. We'll do that in the next segment. I just want to get a rough outline. I mean, what you're telling me is that you were used as some kind of, what phrase would we, interstellar slave.
Yeah, I was a slave. Yeah, I was a slave. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Did you resist?
No. So I was 10 years old. And in the beginning, when I woke up in the first day of my service, I had no memory. I had amnesia. I had no memory of my mom or dad or where I was from or any of that. I woke up with zero memory. And I was put through a mind control program, a trauma-based mind control program, and left with commands, phrases, and the ability so they could give me an electrical shock and I would stop whatever I was doing and await command. And so I was very obedient. It's a very... We're talking about a very advanced technology. Most people, I mean, you're in media, so you can understand how powerful media is. And there is a mass version of subliminal mind control that goes on. And most people are unaware of it.
So you're saying
we're talking about an industrial grade version of that.
Okay, sorry to jump in. You're saying that this made you suggestible then, way beyond a hypnotic way. This made you pliable for them. They could just snap their fingers or use a keyword and you would do whatever was required.
An electric shock. That's right.
Okay. That's a big story. Okay. I think to round out this segment then, I want to know what kind of... this all happened to you when you were 10, and you are not the only one that this has happened to young. That, I know from what I've read, it is claimed. What kind of 10-year-old were you? What kind of family life did you have?
I had a normal family. My father worked for an automaker, had a pretty good job. We lived on an old farmhouse. We had a 13-acre farm, and my mom and my sister and I and my dad lived in the home. And I was a outstanding student at the time. I was in the top 5% of the class and going to talented and gifted program. I was an outstanding student. And after this happened, I was 10. And then after this happened, the following years, I totally withdrew from school and my grades dropped. So I took a hit. You know, I was left with great emotional problems after it happened to me.
So your parents were living the American dream. You had the average American kid's experience. You know, you were, I guess we would say, middle class, you know, in British terms, you were doing okay. And no difficulties at school, no problems that you're aware of, you remember?
Yeah, I was a normal kid. American dream might be a stretch, but we were probably lower middle class. But we were okay, you know, and the future was bright for me at that time. And then, you know, there were other things that I think happened that, you know, that were... Because of this instance, I don't want to, I don't want to throw a dart at the wall and just see where it lands. But this instance really changed our whole family, and it definitely changed me. Like I said, I was left with breathtaking emotional problems after this happened. I came back, you know, I would play hide and seek with my sister, and that weekend we played hide and seek after I returned. I believe I was taken on a Thursday, and that weekend we played hide and seek, and I was claustrophobic all of a sudden. And she was looking for me in places that I couldn't hide because I was afraid to be in small places. So those were things that I didn't understand why the memories were erased, but the emotional problems came with me back.
So the you've used that trauma word once here in terms of the training that you said you were put through. But the trauma of the whole experience in totality, you're saying, understandably, if you went through this, changed you.
Absolutely. And I found that it does that. So I work with people that are trying to understand their own memories. Some people have fragmented memories. It seems that they are, especially in the early years, from the 80s, the 70s, 80s, and 90s, early 90s, they can't erase, they seem to have not had the ability to erase the initial abduction. So the first 30 minutes, like Betty and Barney, they remember the ship. They remember the initial abduction. They don't remember anything after that. That's typical for a lot of people I worked with. After the 90s, it seems like people don't remember anything. They just have witnesses. They have other evidence. But during that time, so people remember the abduction. I always remember the initial abduction, the first 30 minutes. Those memories were not erased. And so I would research. And as I lived my life, it seemed like the other person, so there were two of me, if you think about it, I lived through the 80s twice, because in the early years I was on Earth. And theoretically, I could have met myself. There was another me during that time.
So when you were where you were, wherever it happened to be at the time, you were still using the same calendar, the same reference points.
Yes, yes. And a lot of people have a hard time. We're talking about, you know, everybody's willing to believe in extraterrestrials. Everybody's willing to believe in craft that can go fast. But when you talk about time travel, you really get the 1,000-yard stare out of people. And you need to understand that in order to travel very fast, that also means that you can manipulate time as well. So to travel great distances of space allows you to travel time as well. And they go hand in hand. So it's somebody called it a quantum time dilation. So that's the technical term for what it is. But basically there were two of me, because one of me was sent back in time, killed off at a certain point. So whether it's with cloning tech, like there was a clone of me and half of me was in it and half of me was in my other body, I don't know, but it seems to have been like that. Something like the way I experienced it was the moment I was taken, I lived those 20 years first, then was put back and lived my life in Michigan after that. Like that's the order that I remember it. Like that's the experience that I lived, the abducted 20 years primarily. And when it was over, I went back to the point where I was taken and then lived my life again. And with tendencies of an adult. So
right. So you had, because you'd grown up when you'd been going through that, or the clone of you, or the derivation of you had been through that. Of course,
right.
It was a 20-year program, so you'd have gone to 20 and 30. Then you would have had all of those experiences of a 20 and 30-year-old. And you're saying that, but when they put you back, some of that was still left, the residual.
Yes. And so I didn't have the physical memory, but, you know, I mean, it's hard to say this and, you know, somewhat inappropriate, but in the coming weeks, I found myself attracted to adult women all of a sudden. And I was 10 years old. So this was before the internet. I was not exposed to any kind of pornography. I was not exposed to anything like that. I was completely unaware of sexuality at the time. But I found myself immediately attracted to adult women. And I didn't understand Like I couldn't process it.
So,
I didn't understand
that,
why.
That part of your recollection of that period hadn't been erased. It was still part of you. It was still within you. And that's part of the process, as you said, of returning you. But as your sister noticed, you were changed. You were different.
Emotional things. So I believe that, you know, like I've described it in the past that when you remember a physical memory, you know what I mean? Like, and I always use the birthday. Let's talk about your 21st birthday. It's, you know, most people can remember it here in the United States because you're allowed to start drinking. But so you have memory, so you can actually see a picture in your mind of your 21st birthday. If you can't remember it, you still can remember the emotions of it. You can still remember kind of the emotions. Like, I can't really put my hand on it, but I remember it was a nice day. The emotional memory comes through. It's they're deleting, their memory erasing process doesn't really get the emotions out. So those are what I was left with.
But supposedly also, they tell me, I'm still waiting for proof, but they say that as you get older, you're supposed to get more sensible, and most people do. Weren't you a very grown-up 10-year-old then when you went back?
Right. So I had little interest in many things that my friends did. I really didn't socialize well I had friends. I had a normal childhood afterwards. And a lot of my close friends would ask me, Tone, what's wrong with you? You're not even into what's going on. And I would say, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm not interested in any of this. And later on, when we were in our early years, the bar hopping years, I really had little interest in going to the bar or doing any of that. The normal things. And I had relationship problems. It was hard to date. And so it's worth being, so another thing that is prevalent and with people that I work in, and that was prevalent with myself as well, is that at the end of the 20 years, so when I lived 20 years in my normal life, one day I woke up and it was like everything just went away and I got my act together. I immediately straightened right out. It was all, I woke up one morning and I said, it's over. I kept saying it to myself, it's over, it's over.
And chronologically, that was 20 years.
20 years later.
After
yes.
that. Let's park it there then. Tony Rodriguez is here. We're talking about the secret space program. And a man here who says he's not alone in having the experience of being taken and used as an interstellar slave. All right, Tony, before we get stuck into the stories of the places that you went, talk to me about the night, the experience of being taken when you were 10 years of age. You know, who did it? How did it happen? And where did you go?
Well, it's worth mentioning that in school, there was so I was in the talented and gifted program. And there was a boy in there that I didn't get along with who was very smart, who had something like a 200 IQ. And he didn't like me. And he said, my dad's an Illuminati. What's your dad do? That's how I remember that conversation and how awkward it was.
A bizarre thing to say.
It, absolutely. And his dad came in and was the judge for the science fair, because the kids in that class were the ones with the science fair exhibits. And when I walked by him and his father in the cafeteria setting up our science fair exhibits, he pointed me out to him and said, Dad, that's that boy I told you about. And they had a strange conversation about me I did not understand. And I just kept walking. I didn't make any note of it. But it was that night or the following night. I believe that was a Wednesday, and I believe on Thursday I was taken. So it was immediately after that I was taken. And it was in the middle of the night, I was on a farmhouse that was far away from the road from other houses. And there was a bright light outside shining down like a spotlight from above. And we had the old style phone ringer, you know, the ones that the phone would have the long cord so you could walk in the other room and talk on the phone. Mm-hmm. That would start ringing and it would keep ringing and ringing and then stop and the light would disappear. And then the light would come back and the phone would start ringing again. And then there was silence. There were a few other things that happened. It was kind of a long sequence of events. And then I woke up and there was someone standing over me. And my father had a very good sense of humor and would pull pranks on us. And I thought he had a mask on. And I said, Dad, quit, take the mask off. You're not funny. And I reached up and touched its face and it was cold and wet and very porous. And it was a gray alien. What, you know, everybody's seen what the rendition of a gray. And I went to scream and it stuck me with something and I froze. I was frozen. And I remember three other shorter reptilian looking beings coming around my bed and lifting me up and carrying me to the end of my bed. And then a flash of light. And I woke up on a table, like a stainless steel surgical table in a room somewhere. They had taken me to a base. And that's how it began. That was the night of.
Right.
And
those were where do you? I mean, I'm not asking you to give me a city, but where do you think the base was? Presumably, this was on Earth, was it?
I believe it was either inside the moon or underground somewhere in the United States. They told me at one point, but I don't remember exactly. Mm-hmm. They told me, but I didn't understand. Like they gave me a name that I was unaware of. So they told me where I was, but I didn't understand where it was. You know what I mean? So I don't recall.
So you were 10 years of age. You must have been, if I was 10 and that happened to me, I would have been hysterical.
Well, I was thrilled. Really? I thought it was a first contact situation. I was into sci-fi, you know, we had Star Wars and everything. And I thought, this is it. I even said to them, so there was telepathic communication. And I even said, like, I knew you guys were real. You're going to be our friends now. Right. And they were, because they immediately, when I woke up, they immediately, you're going to be fine. They were telling me reassuring things. We're not going to hurt you. You're going to be fine. We grabbed you. You know, mm-hmm. I forget what they said. We want you to help us with something.
All right. Well, listen, I was a sci-fi fan. I'd have freaked out though. 10.
Well, I thought that the next day I was going to wake up and it would be on the news that ETs were here. And that was first contact. That was what was going through that was really the feeling I had. Mm-hmm. And so I was willing to help them. They asked me for their help. And they said, they explained to me, he said, we're going to take you for 20 years and put you back. And I said, no, I can't do that. I won't grow up with my parents and my mom and dad. And they said, no, you're very lucky that you're chosen for this because there's time travel. We're going to put you right back tonight. But for you, you will have lived an extra 20 years. This is a very, how did he put it? You know, you're very fortunate. It's a very fortunate thing.
They're telling you you're privileged, and you understood that at 10, that they were telling you that we're going to give you 20 years, but you're not going to lose 20 years.
Yes, exactly. They explained it to me and I said, well, I'm willing to help, you know? So yes, they had to get consent. They had to get my consent. That was the thing.
That's
and as soon as they did that, they mm-hmm. threw me back on a table and stuck a needle in my eye. Mm-hmm. And I woke
your eye.
Up. Yeah. In the tear duct of my eye, there's a big needle. And it felt like, yeah, I don't know, Howard, if you've ever been, anybody's ever gave you a good right hook to the eyeball, but that you kind of see stars if you get hit really hard.
Well, and anything to do exactly with it. I mean, look, I had laser correction surgery a little while back, and I was in mortal terror because of, not because it hurt or anything. You know, I was out of it. I wasn't aware of that, but it was just something coming towards my eye.
Yeah. So that was exactly the process. They actually did a test to see which one was my dominant eye. And, that was the dominant eye, right? Like right in the tear duct, there was a big needle in that. So that's where they access your consciousness or seemingly what they did. And I woke up with, like, again, with on the earth, in what I found, recently, in Yokern airfield, there were three portable buildings there. And I remember the place I found it. And I've also found a lot of documents supporting my claim. This is part of the evidence, is that I woke up on Inyokern and I was in
I'm jumping in again, but whereabouts is that?
It's in Southern California, and it's mm-hmm. just west, probably 15-minute drive west of China Lake, where there's a huge Air Force base. It's a very military area. But it was there, and it was the remnants of something that I believe was Project Grill Flame, was a CIA remote viewing research program that was funded. I found funding. And a lot of the cast of characters I've kind of dug up, and I don't know how much of this I want to say it, you know, publicly, but I've connected a lot of dots to that program and to that time, to 1982. And
you believe, just to clarify that point, as far as you can and want to, you think there's some kind of connection with secret programs that were going on, you know, that were black budget, black ops organized by the American government? You think there was some kind of link, certainly in the location, at least?
Absolutely. Mm. Oh, without a doubt. Oh. So the other thing I found is the buildings that I identified way back in 2015, when I had like a big recall, you know, moment when I remembered everything, and I didn't have anybody. And I'll tell you, that's the scariest thing, because if there's nobody to talk to and you're all alone with, I had 20 years of memories dumped on me all of a sudden. And so the only people I could speak to were researchers. And I contacted three or four researchers, and they worked with me. And it was really, I wanted therapy. I wanted someone to speak to, but they were the only ones that knew what they were talking about. And it, when you talk to a researcher, they're asking you questions, and they're not giving you a yes or no. Like, yeah, that makes sense. There's none of that. So it really wasn't great therapy. But a lot of things checked out. And one thing that I found is that, so back then, the other thing is that everything was documented in 2015. So things have come to light since then that have supported what I said, like events on Ceres. But what I found was the buildings that I identified in 2015. So there's a database in the United States of every structure in the United States has to have a tax assessment. Every building on the entire country has a tax assessment, and there's a website with it. And what I found was that the buildings that I've identified that are on Google, that, you know, I have pictures of, you can go on Google Earth and look at them. They're there. They don't exist in the tax structure. And furthermore, because they're designated a special district, the local law enforcement has no jurisdiction inside those buildings. So that was something that I, you know, I pointed out, and then it kind of panned out that, you know, the program that I remember going through in those buildings turned out was perfectly legal by the, I think the military police doesn't have jurisdiction. Somebody, like, you need congressional authority to go in there with the law enforcement.
All right. But you said at the beginning of this conversation that you were subjected to a, quote, trauma-based training program.
That's right. And that was myself and probably a dozen other kids. And the daily routine was, we would wake up, they'd feed us, and then move us into there were three separate buildings. They'd move us into a different building, and we would hang from chairs that were hang like swings that were bolted to the ceiling. And they gave us, drugs like a hallucinogenic drug. I don't know what it was. And we would watch movies, and the movies had words that would flash quickly, subliminal, and they would go in between, you know, war scenes and gory things, and then like cartoons, Disney cartoons, and it would play over and over again for hours and hours. And then at the end of the day, he would take us in one by one to his office in the other building and ask us questions about what we remembered and what we thought about it.
This is what you're describing is both barbaric and inhumane, and also by anybody's, you know, stretch of the imagination or analysis of the law, illegal.
I don't know, you say
that there were other kids there. Were some of you protesting? What sort of state were you all in?
In the beginning, some kids did, but he explained to us, he was very matter of fact and basically a likable villain. The doctor that was in charge, and he had a book, so it was his first time, and he had a guidebook, and there were other things. They put us in cages that electrified, so we were getting electrified until we would kind of surrender, and that happened a few times.
Good God. And when you asked, why are you doing this to me, which you must have done, what were you
told? No, he explained it all. He explained it all in the very beginning, that you guys are part of a program, and this is for science. We're going to medical science, and this is for remote viewing and extrasensory perception. This is your, you know, and he explained it. That was our purpose in life. That was our whole purpose in life, was to further the research. And he said, and once kids, there were times when we were hurt, you know, at the end of the day, and he said, I'm a doctor. I'll make you better. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about the pain.
Shouldn't the people who did this, if they're still alive, any of them, be located and brought to book for it?
I think the first, now we're talking about a larger problem with disclosure. I mean, so it seems to me that looking at it like that is just going to keep it hidden longer. I understand that feeling of wanting to bring justice to these people, but it's been going on for so long. I think the most important thing is just that people know it exists. That's the thing. That's what we're up against is, you know, children are being taken.
You think it's still going on? You think it's still going on?
I don't see why it wouldn't be. It was very effective. It was a very effective thing. And and think about this, to anybody, if you personally, and I'm talking to everybody listening to this, if you personally could take anybody you wanted with no repercussion, with no possibility of being in trouble for it, and then blank their mind and make them basically do anything you wanted for a period of time, for let's say 5 years, and then put them back exactly where they were. I mean, how fast would it take? How long would it be before your morals is a slippery slope? How long would it be before it became abusive?
Some people would do that. I think it's way outside my and most other people's moral code. I think it sounds appalling. Absolutely appalling. At what stage did you get involved with space then? Here you are going through this program. It was preparing you for something.
Right. So that program ended with us. So it went into a phase of sleep deprivation. And after that, I kind of lost all track of time, where they would wake us up every 15 minutes all night. And they would come in and a buzzer would go off. The lights would come on. We'd have to stand by our bed. And then they would come in and slap us, and then we could go back to sleep. And then another time they'd come in and they could shock us with a cattle prod, and we could go back to sleep. And that went on for, after the first few days, I lost all track of time. I really don't know after that, but they were drugging us, and we would get an IV, and I would pass out. And during that time, I was giving information. So somebody else was talking through me. They were accessing either your higher self or some other being or whatever. I don't know, but they were getting remote viewing information. They could access past and future and current events far away. And they had accurate information.
And they were using you to do it.
About a dozen of us kids that I remember. And I was shipped off to Peru, and I lived there for a couple years. I was on the earth, actually, out of the 20 years, I spent the first six you know, and it's not like they celebrated my birthday, but maybe the first six to eight years I spent on Earth before I was sold into the space program.
I read somewhere that you say that you were involved in drug running in Peru.
That's exactly right. So in Peru, that was my first stop after that. After Inyokern, I went to Seattle for about a week and then shipped to Peru. And what it was, Puerto Tahuantinsuyo, and I'm sure I'm saying it wrong. I always mess up the Juan, but it's Puerto Tahuantinsuyo, Peru. It was a river town, and they were moving vast amounts of cocaine. They were bringing cocaine up, was being produced in the jungle, and then brought up a little at a time on the river and kept in a warehouse. And when they had a plane load of it about once a month, a plane would fly it from there to Santa Marta, Colombia, to the airport. And I presume it was shipped to the United States after that.
But from what I've read and what I know from, you know, covering news stories for decades, they had plenty of mules. Why did they need you?
The reason that I was told during that time that I was in this program was because they lost a plane. One of the plane prior to me crashed. And so what they would do is we would take off. And when we got over the state of Acre, you know, a few hours into the flight, they would lay me on a bunk and give me an IV in my arm, and I would go under. And during that time, I was an alert system. I would tell them about weather, where they were lost, or, you know, if there were police waiting. I was
trained to do remote viewing to know those things. Is that right?
Yes. That's okay. What the program was. That's what I was. And in the beginning, I didn't work. There was talk about killing me because they had to pay for me to be there. And after what happened was they said that while I was under the EM fields from the airplane's instruments may have been interfering. So they sent a silver mesh blanket down. And on the second flight, they wrapped me up in a silver mesh blanket. And the guy who was very skeptical, he was the only one that could speak English in the village, was the one that would put me under. And when I went under, you know, he was skeptical. When I woke up, he was in shock. He said that I was speaking fluent Spanish, that he spoke to his grandmother, and that I was a completely different person. And he was in shock. And after that, a few months later, he would have a notepad of questions from everybody in the town that he would ask me while I was under during the flight. So that was basically, if you think about that capability, that if you think about that as a technology, so a lot of people confuse it with a religious context, but or, you know, channeling or whatever. You think about that as a reliable technology, it's no wonder that you can't, the war on drugs is a fail.
I mean, look, it's a chilling and scary story, and I'm taking your word for it, because time is always a problem when you do these programs, unfortunately. I need to move it on a bit, Tony. How did you get, you know, you were sold off, weren't you? You were sold on,
Yes. And
you say that you ended up on Mars.
The first stop was the back of the moon, and we went through a training program, and it was another, more of the same, but a better technology of programming. And all they did was train, you know, like a subliminal programming, mind control, of fight or flight response to make it to where we wouldn't run if we were in the face of danger, that we would just stand and fight. That was the entire military programming. And then I was put on a craft and flown to Mars. As soon as we landed inside a hangar, they put bags over our heads and put us on a smaller craft and flew us to a forward base that was underground. It was five levels, I believe, underground and on Mars. And we did support missions. So they had U.S. Marines there for soldiers, and they had contractors. It looked like a modern, like a school. Like the inside of the facility looked like what you would see in a modern school that's built. I don't know what they are over there where you're at, but
so it looked like. The confusing thing about this is, if there were underground operations happening, and if there are underground operations happening on Mars, why are we sending space probes, you know, to look at Mars, to analyze Mars? Why is Perseverance there? Why are we wasting all the money if people know that it's being done already?
Well, I can only speculate, and what I can, I mean, you know, there, you look at a few obvious things that why, how they do business, but firstly, I don't believe that NASA costs that much. I think a lot of that money is just going into these other programs that are more advanced. Secondly, if people were aware we would want access to the technology, and which is one thing. But then the people, like you said, the people that are doing these appalling things would have to be brought to justice, or at least answer to somebody.
So what was being, just as we, I've got to bring this segment to a close, but just as we do, what was being done on Mars? Were they mining? What were all those people, including you, there for?
There is life there. Mars has indigenous species there. There's an insectoid species that is very intelligent, that they are basically insects. There are giant bugs on Mars. It's, you know what I mean? Like, that doesn't roll off the tongue easily to say that, but it's the truth. And they're territorial, and they were testing weaponry, you know, military tactics. They're testing them against the insectoids are only territorial. In other words, you can go in and kill them off in an area, but once you leave the area, they don't, there's not a state of war. It's just when you go into this. So they are a perfect test bed for weaponry.
So, Tony, you're on Mars. What were you doing? What was your role?
It was a support soldier.
Support soldier.
We were given environmental suits. You can breathe some of the atmosphere. So when we would exert, there was a cone-shaped mask that we had. And when we exerted ourselves, it would give us oxygen. But it was a bright white. The entire suit was white. So we stood out. So we were basically in a bounding maneuver as bait. And then the real soldiers would be in the distance, hidden. And if we were engaged by the insects during a hiking, you know, we would go out on hiking missions. And if we were engaged, they would engage them at distance. So we were basically bait. And what they were trying to do was they couldn't match the numbers. The insectoids could just reproduce. They couldn't get that many soldiers in the program. It was expensive. So they were trying to find a cheaper alternative. And they were people like me, that they could take from anywhere and minimally equip and train and just get on the field, just boots on the field.
So you could have died doing this.
I was badly injured, and we did have losses. We did suffer losses.
And what happened to those people who were lost then? If they'd been abducted like you, then could they be resurrected and put back in their beds age 10? What would happen to people who would die in that way?
It's only a theory of mine. I really don't have any firsthand experience or anything other than I think that you would go right back. So I think that the original, I believe that when they take you for this program into a 20 and back, and then the other one of you dies, I believe the host just retains the consciousness. The consciousness finds its way back to the host body, and they just put you back. So I think it would explain the aggressiveness of the program, of the things that they do, their actions that they take.
What can you tell us about Mars that we haven't discovered yet?
I believe we were surgically modified to breathe better there, which it still wasn't great. But there's a huge belt on Mars that's warm, that gets into the 60s and 70s in the middle of the day. There were ruins. We came across an area while we were hiking where, you know how people tend to go like in rivers and stack river rocks up and make a tower out of rocks? People do it all the time. On hiking paths, they'll take small rocks and make a stack of rocks.
I've seen that even over here, yeah.
There were giant ones on Mars like that, that were ancient. And the soldiers that we were hiking with said not to touch them, that they'd already been studied by the scientists, but they were millions of years old. And there were ruins like that.
Why are we not seeing evidence of this? Why isn't, Perseverance has got a helicopter, and we've looked far and wide on the landing sites that we've been at, but we're not seeing evidence of this.
The rovers really don't cover a large amount of the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter gets a great deal of the surface, but everybody's aware that NASA's very adept at hiding things. When you think about the size of exploration of the rovers, I mean, you know, somebody said you could put a rover in California and at the distance, it would never in the desert in California, and it wouldn't know that there's plants there.
So you assert that NASA knows about this program, and the pictures and images that we see are manipulated so that we don't see evidence of what you were involved in. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. Well, and not only
that's going to sound to some people very far-fetched.
Some people are going to take it very offended, and it would be weird. Mm-hmm. it would be weird if everybody believed everything I said on the first go. So I would encourage everybody to not just take what I say as verbatim, go and research it, go and research 20 and back, research all of this. But in what's important is that in physics, in academia, many elements, theoretical elements that lead to the anti-grav propulsion and the basically the cornerstone of the space program is anti-grav. The cornerstone technology is gravity manipulation, and all the elements needed for a machine to do that were discovered in the 1800s. The golden age of physics was in the 20th century. So from what, 18 to 1900. But that's been taken. They only had to manipulate a small amount of data so that nobody can discover it again. And all the physics, you know, your college degree that you pay for in physics today has some very important things missing from it. So that's the cornerstone of the entire next age of mankind is gravity manipulation. And they do it with certain elements that are manufactured. And so that's been hidden from us.
Tony, you say that after Mars, you ended up on Ceres, which, just to remind my listener, is, well, I've got a definition of it here, the largest astronomical object in the asteroid belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, first discovered 1st of January 1801. And you say that you were taken there. What did you do?
So that's a breakaway German civilization that was given jurisdiction over Ceres to create a Ceres colony there by the Draco, by the Orion group. And there was an existing base there made by some other species long ago. And they went in and began to convert it to human-type architecture. And then they began mining so that they could build out throughout the inner side of the asteroid. There's water there. There's a great deal of water, a subterranean ocean or subterranean seas, that they, when they find water, they drain it out, and then they build into the cavern. And what they found was that there's a lot of, there's another species that used to live there, and they are trading. So from the Ceres Colony Corporation, there were about 225,000 people and a few other ET species living there full time. And then abductees like me as slave labor. And they were both building there and then trading on interstellar flights for technology with other species. And there's no limit, there's no bottom to the list of species to trade with. The cosmos are accessible. We did flights. We left in the morning and we got back in the morning. They would time travel and come back right when we left. And we would go to elsewhere in our galaxy and, in fact, other galaxies. So interstellar travel is much easier than what we've been led to believe by even our most fantastic sci-fi representations of space travel don't show it as easy as what I remember we did on our flights. I was a ship maintenance for about 8 years, and then I was promoted and I was a cargo engineer, and I did cargo input basically for the last couple years that I was there, and then I was put back.
So you returned to being 10 again?
Yes, after all that. Right?
Boy, I mean, this is a hell of a story. I suppose that as we come to the end of this now, I think the one question to ask about it is that a lot of this stuff is very detailed. I would have thought you would be able to nail this with absolute proof by going to an astronomer and saying, if you point your telescope or your radio telescope here, then you're going to see that everything that I've been saying about this is absolutely true. Have you done that?
Well, I did a little bit of that. So when the Dawn probe began to close in on Ceres, the NASA sent a Dawn probe. They had found on long distance telescopes had looked at Ceres and found water vapor. So they immediately, NASA is on a trail for. So there's a public program and then there's a secret program. And the public program is to appease us. And, you know, they've lied to us. So I say it's too expensive to go to the moon. You know, that's ridiculous by now. But they found water and they sent a probe there, and the probe showed images of a crater with, they called it lights, but they were white spots inside the, what's called the O'Connor crater. I'm not sure if I'm even pronouncing that right, but that crater, I remembered flying over it in, I believe, around 1998. Mm-hmm. We flew over it. There's a geyser there. And at the time I stood on a spacecraft and looked out the window with a German officer, and we were looking down at all the piles of salt. They were salt. And I said, there's got to be something we can do with that. We can trade that. Look at all of it. There's miles and miles of salt. And
so you're saying that if we look for that, we're going to find it.
Well, I'm saying they did. We did already. So the Dawn Pro, I was working with a researcher at the time. And, and he said, what are these? And I said, that's salt. That's regular salt with a little bit of magnesium. And the Dawn probe at the time concluded in 2015 or early 16, they said that NASA said that it was probably a cocktail of sulfur and a bunch of other chemicals. And I said, no, it's salt. Trust me, it's salt. So I went on record with this in 2015. In August of 2020, the results from the spectrometer came back, or whatever test they did that NASA did, and they concluded that it's salt. It's briny salt, so it's from sea salt, because those are geyser spots. And I watched the geyser. I was told when I was on series that the geyser went off randomly between every 6 and 9 years.
Tony, this is incredible stuff. I'm sorry that I'm having to wrap you now, but they're telling me that I've got to stop now because we've got to get to news and commercials and all sorts of stuff. That's a hell of a story. I'd like to talk with you again because there's a lot we haven't talked about. So, let's try and do that. If people want to read about you, I've looked at your website today. Tell people where it is.
So I have a book coming out. The book has been in pre-sale. We sold over 50% of the 100 copies that we have up in the first 10 days. And my website is tonyrodriguez.com. So it's Rodriguez with an S on the end. But tonyrodriguez.com, I do consultations and I have shows there. I have links to other interviews I've done. All my information is out. You can't cover it all in 2 hours or four for that matter. It's just too
indeed,
much.
Or indeed 52 minutes, I think, as I'm discovering.
That's right.
Your thoughts welcome about Tony Rodriguez and his story. We may talk to him again. Please go to my website, theunexplained.tv, and you can send me an email about anything from there. And don't forget to tell me when you get in touch who you are, where you are in this world or any other world that you happen to be on, where you are and how you use this show. So that's who you are, where you are, and how you use this show. Sorry, it's been a long day. More great guests in the pipeline here at The Unexplained, so until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online, and please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.